Welcome once again to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? I'm the former military officer, Ray Powell, in California, and I am joined, as always, by the former diplomat, Jim Caruso, in New York. Jim, I just returned from cross-country, from Virginia, where I visited many fine 2.5-star hotels across the country along Interstate 40, and I understand you did something very similar last week.
Similar. I was in Spain. And I would say my food was better than yours, but I was really struck, and actually our guest may appreciate this, the sense of history there with the different layers and different civilizations all piled on top of each other and how each affected the other is really in your face. And the wine is excellent.
Well, it's probably better than what I was imbibing on along I-40. Anyway, Jim, our audience has been clamoring for some quality content regarding the Korean Peninsula. And despite the fact that we had former Ambassador Harry Harris on not long ago, we haven't really spent a lot of time talking about North Korea, South Korea, really an incredibly important part of the region. And that's a huge hole in our lineup. And so we're really happy today to have with us Republic of Korea retired Lieutenant General Chun In-bum. General Chun is a career officer with a very broad range of experiences. He's actually even served in Iraq and Afghanistan. He is also a highly experienced special operations officer, including service as the commander of the Republic of Korea Special Warfare Command. General Chun, welcome, sir. And let me start you off with our first question. And I warned you in advance that this would happen, that we're very interested in this topic of North Korea supplying Russia with weapons for its war in Ukraine. And we like to ask the question, why should we care about this? So why should we care about North Korea supplying Russia with weapons?
Yes, thank you very much for this invitation. But before I go into that question, I would be remiss as a Korean if I did not thank the American people for the support and service that your men and women have given the Republic of Korea. And with this support, with the sacrifice of the American people, we Koreans have been able to develop our country, become a democratic nation, and now pay back by providing the world with many, many goods. And that was South Korea. Unfortunately, North Korea is a little different. And this goes to your question. It's not just about North Korea and the Russians. Even before, North Korea was a supplier of weapons to unworthy elements in the world. In fact, 10, 15 years ago, small arms sales were at about $1 billion a year. That's a lot of grenades and that's a lot of ammunition. So they've been at it for a long time. The missiles that you see in Iran right now, they really look like, you know, North Korean design. And it's not as if the Iranians are giving the North Koreans technology. So the South Koreans, we mastered the art of making great cell phones and cars and washing machines. And the North Koreans mastered the art of making missiles. And so these weapons have been around and have been supplied to many of our adversaries and enemies. And now it's now with the Russians. So we now think the Russians have been supplied at least 1 million to up to maybe 3 million rounds of artillery shells. And these artillery shells account for 70% of the Ukrainian casualties. And all of this, you can just pause for a few seconds and think about the second and third order effects that these weapons must be having right now. What are they freeing the Russians to make? What are they causing in not only direct casualties, but the kinds of propaganda that usage that can come from this? And so it's not just even ammunition, it's missiles. We know that we have North Korean soldiers there, either helping to build things or to provide expertise. And unfortunately for us South Koreans, these North Koreans are learning lessons on how to kill us as well, our South Korean people. So all of this is a butterfly effect that affects everybody. And that is why we need to care, because it's not just a Russian-Ukrainian problem. It's not just my problem. It's all of our problem. And ladies and gentlemen, it's a big problem.
So what is North Korea getting from Russia for all this weaponry? Are they getting cash? Are they getting technology?
Yeah. So I just want to be clear that a lot of people don't agree with me. They are saying, oh, this is a transactional relationship. As soon as the war is over, it'll be very transactional. The North Koreans and the Russians, they'll never be buddy buddies, which is true. When I say buddy buddies, I mean the South Korean-U.S. relationship. Our relationship is really tight, especially in the security area. But Putin is desperate. And so for me, as a former military person who always prepares for the worst, I think they're going to give him everything. And if Putin doesn't give him everything, how hard do you think it's going to be to bribe a Russian storage factory manager or a Russian scientist? You know, what the North Koreans need right now is, on the military side, ICBM technology. They have the range, but they lack a little bit on the rest, reentry, targeting, precision, that kind of stuff. If a Russian scientist, he knows that Putin is looking the other way and is offered $2 million, do you think he's going to give North Korea what he has? I think he's going to give North Korea what he has. So that's a big worry. So I just assume that the North Koreans will get everything. Added to that, they're now getting food, fuel, and tourism, which provides them with direct money from Russia. One aspect of this is we're seeing that the Chinese seem to be unhappy. Last month, according to statistics, 17% of trade between the Chinese and North Korea have decreased. And they've been saying everything is good, everything is kumbaya. You know, when these guys say everything's good, there must be something wrong, right? If it was good, they wouldn't need to say that. So they're saying we love each other, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, I think there's something going on.
Well,
so that
brings
might
us,
be
I think,
some good news.
Yeah, that brings us to kind of the question of whether what we see here, and we get a lot of conversation about this, I think, these days, is whether this is the formation of some kind of a new axis between North Korea, China, Russia, Iran, Venezuela, other bad actors, or is it much more nuanced and complex than that, where, you know, you see China becoming uneasy about the new bromance between Putin and Kim?
Yeah, so the Russians and the North Koreans have signed or reaffirmed their agreement, saying that if one is attacked, that they will come to the other in military aid. So bilateral relationships exist. Now, are these nations all against the United States? The answer is self-evident. They want to get rid of U.S. Involvement and hegemony and take its place. So once that is done, that's stage one, and then I guess they'll, you know, fight amongst themselves. But our main concern is my close neighbor, the Chinese, because they're really beefing up their capabilities. And it's not just ships and submarines and ICBMs. Have you seen what they're doing with their little kids? 5, 6, 7 year olds, preschoolers, junior, senior high school kids, college kids, they're all getting basic military training. So, and a lot of indoctrination. So, I think that the future, if we're not prepared, is not going to be easy for any of us.
So, the North Korean leader, Kim, announced that there's no longer any interest in reunification of the two Koreas, on the part of North Korea. What does that signify, and what's he after now?
Well, what he actually said was, number one, he now considers the Republic of Korea enemy. Now, that's very strong language on the Korean Peninsula, even calling us the Republic of Korea. And before all of this, they referred to us as South Korea, which implies that they're North Korea, we're South Korea, and we're one Korea. By addressing us as the Republic of Korea, they're just identifying us as a separate entity. Secondly, what he said might be what you said, but what he meant was peaceful unification is not our goal. So up until now, at least in verbiage and in writing, we, North and South Korea, have always said we're going to resolve our differences peacefully. That was our foundation. He actually said, well, maybe not peacefully. And if there is a contingency on the Korean Peninsula that they would use force to unify South Korea. So it's bad news for us, because it's really short of a declaration of war. And as we speak today, the North Koreans are having their Supreme People's meeting, which is like a great congressional meeting in North Korea. We are very concerned that in this meeting, as a result, they will change their constitution to state that we are now separate states, and to say that territorial rights exist. That's a code word for our Northwest Islands. Northwest Islands, there's some real big issues over there. And North Korea mentioning this, writing about this, putting it in stone, is very concerning. And so things on the Korean Peninsula, the tensions are normal. It's always been high, so it's normal.
So if I go back into my memory banks when thinking of how U.S. policy toward the Korean Peninsula has changed over the years, I can think back to the 90s when we had the six-party talks, and then we sort of had, then we, you know, after the 9/11, we had the Axis of Evil, you know, language began to come out. But then we went through this period where we were leaning heavily on China, trying to get China to sort of manage the North Korea problem. And then we went into this very interesting period, of course, late last decade, where we went from Fire and Fury and Little Rocket Man to love letters between Kim Jong-un and President Trump, and that these personal interactions, summits. And, you know, in your mind, you look back on this, what policy that the U.S. has taken, what has actually worked? Has anything worked? And what would work going forward in the future?
We made a basic mistake in our assumptions. We assumed that we could denuclearize the North Koreans. Now, to be fair, maybe there was a chance. But knowing what we know about North Korea, North Korea is a Kim family cult. The most important thing for North Korea is for the Kim family to survive. And they have created a system, a structure that protects the Kim family. And they have accomplices that they call their elites, that is the mainstream of their organization. And because of the illegitimacy of that organization, because of the criminality of that organization, murderers, killers, they've starved people, their own people. They know that they would never be able to get away with it if there was any justice in the international community. And so they needed something that would protect them, and that was nuclear weapons. And we thought, they would not make, we could persuade them to not make it, that we could do it through negotiations, that we could do it with a carrot, that we could use the Chinese. No, that was the basic mistake that we made. So it was like being diagnosed with cancer. The first stage is denial, right? So I think and then of course, guys, let's be honest, our politicians, they just wished that it would just not happen. So to all those people who were involved and who had these thoughts, know this, you're going to burn in hell for this. Now, when I was a colonel in the 2000s and even in the mid 90s, I said, look, we got to get them before they get nuclear weapons. But now it's too late and we're faced with this the situation. So what are we going to do now? You know, is our big question. And so we need to think about that.
Well, it's actually pretty interesting. As you know, we have a modest little presidential campaign going on here in the U.S. Foreign policy is almost not mentioned at all, including Korea. And yet, as you point out, the risks there are enormous. And it's not clear what the policies of our two candidates might be. I guess my question to you is, given Trump's apparent transactional approach to alliances, what should South Korea do if he starts trying again to make nice with Kim, or trying to charge Korea more for the basing, or even pull out? What are South Korea's options?
This is Im Bum Chun speaking, not my government. But if Mr. Trump tries to renegotiate with Kim Jong-un, I would say, hey, sir, good luck. You know, as long as they're talking, they're not shooting. If Mr. Trump wants more money, I will say, sure, well, fine. Just tell me what you're going to use it for. You know, that we just concluded a special measures agreement. That's the cost sharing agreement that we would increase by 8.4%, which is about close to $1 billion a year. And so that was a good agreement. It will last from 2026 to 2030 if ratified by both nations. So, but if Mr. Trump demands for more, and there's been speculation that that Korea should be paying, we're now at 2.7% of our GDP. Some Americans have suggested it needs to go up to 3.5%, which is what the United States is sharing for its military, which is fine. You know, I resent the fact that I'm being told that what I should do with my budget, but as a former military guy, I would welcome an increase. We need more money for defense anyway. So I would just ask Mr. Trump, you know, where is he going to use it? And I would also appreciate receipts for what's being used. So I think, you know, a lot of Koreans are skittish about more money, but I personally am okay with it. Now, having said that, could you please ask your European friends to do the same before you push on and lean on us poor Koreans?
I'd like to go back to the question of North Korea's nuclear arsenal. And it wasn't very long ago that standard language out of Washington, D.C. was something like, we will not accept a nuclear North Korea. Is that essentially ancient history at this point? Can we retire that and say that's a done deal? We need to move on and figure out how do we deal with a nuclear North Korea. Is that accurate?
Well, yes and no. So everybody now needs to accept that North Korea has nuclear weapons. So are they a nuclear weapons state? Yes. Should we acknowledge that? Once we acknowledge that, it's the end of the non-proliferation treaty. And so I think that's where people are very careful in not stating that North Korea is a weapon state. But the reality is they have nuclear weapons, and they're not going to give it up.
Sorry, let me follow that up. If we live in that reality, when does the conversation start, and does the conversation start in places like South Korea and Japan as to whether or not U.S. extended nuclear deterrence is sufficient, or whether your country and Japan need their own nuclear arsenal? And we're talking about the end of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. You know, is that the beginning of the great unraveling?
Many Koreans think so, and I assume our neighbors think so as well. But most of us trust the trust extended deterrence that is being provided by the United States. And there have been some real significant initiatives by the U.S. government with the Republic of Korea in recent years in assuring the South Koreans of the extended deterrence and putting in some more detail into the assurance of extended deterrence. But having said all of that, and I say this very carefully because some of the reaction that I get is, you mean you don't trust America? And no, it's not that. Just because your wife wants an extra insurance policy doesn't mean she doesn't trust you. You know, it doesn't mean she doesn't trust your driving. You never know what's going to happen in the world. And so people in Korea are scared. And we're scared of North Korea, but we're more scared about China. China has been our problem for 5,000 years. And America's stance is very important to us because it's directly related to our survival. And so a lot of Koreans think we need our own indigenous nuclear capability, which should be considered an extension of U.S. nuclear weapons. I mean, think about it. South Korean nuclear weapons will never attack American interests or American territory, right? South Korean nuclear weapons will never attack American interests or the United States. So it's an extension of U.S. nuclear capability. And my understanding is U.S. nuclear capability needs a boost right this moment. So you're going to have to invest anyway. And we're talking about, you know, financial costs. Let us pay for it. We can share with you these capabilities in defending the Pacific on behalf of the United States or with the United States.
So what you're saying is to have nuclear weapons positioned in South Korea under some sort of joint control?
That is to be discussed, but yeah.
All I can think is the Chinese went nuts over the THAADs being positioned there. What would they react with nuclear weapons?
Yeah, you know, I don't ask Chinese for permission, things like that. Oh, by the way, you know, they had the chance of stopping the North Koreans for sure. You know, and yet they didn't. They thought that it was better to have a nuclear-armed North Korea than having a free world next to their borders. Well, live up to it. And if they don't like South Korea having nuclear weapons, I don't care.
Well, but I mean, it does get back to, and again, it gets back to this whole question of non-proliferation, right? And how, you know, it's actually been a remarkably successful regime, despite the fact that there have been additional states that have you know, developed nuclear weapons technology, and there are obviously more states than we started with, and yet so far it hasn't sort of gone everywhere. You know, but the question then becomes: are there ways to still fit in this arrangement within the spirit of non-proliferation without just kind of uncorking the bottle and seeing the champagne, you know, spray everywhere?
Well, I guess if you're familiar with the term latency, instead of having actual nuclear weapons, having the capability to have nuclear weapons at a very short notice is an alternative that South Korea might feel comfortable with, as well as its neighbors. But having said that, I think for South Korea, we need to have American soldiers on the Korean Peninsula as a symbol of U.S. resolve and promise to provide extended deterrence. That's number one. Number two, I think the NPT has needs to be changed. We need an NPT too, because of North Korea. And let's face it, guys, Iran, you know, just the other day, the North Koreans showed off their centrifuges. Some people think there's 10,000 of them. Some people think there's 20,000 of them. North Koreans are making their own centrifuges. How many of those do you think might have ended up in Tehran? I would assume thousands already. So if not, they're making it and they're exporting it over there. So there's another, you know, loophole in the system. So we need an NPT too, something that's more realistic. And these thugs, they will only understand strength. We know that. Let's face up to that. And so that's the world that we live in.
So, you know, you're pretty clear about the threat that China poses South Korea. Ray and I have discussed a lot about the threat China poses to countries around the South China Sea. We won't even mention Taiwan right now. But we're constantly struck by the lack of concern evidenced by some of the Southeast Asian countries. Now, South Korea has lately had a policy of trying to reach out to them, do more military cooperation with them. Do you think that might be more effective, having a fellow Asian country talk to these countries about the risk of China and how to cooperate to push back?
And I'll just add to Jim's question, since, of course, today, I believe President Yoon is still in Manila, where he's just announced an upgraded strategic partnership with the Philippines.
Actually, President Yoon has just arrived in Singapore. Singapore is our second largest trade partner in Southeast Asia. So he's there right now talking about these great things. But yes and no, I guess. South Korea is not accustomed to being having the responsibilities as a regional leader, but we're aspiring to that. So I guess we can lead the charge. But let me just say one thing. South Korea and the United States are blood allies. We have this alliance through a war on the Korean Peninsula. And by treaty, if Americans are hurt or killed in this neck of the woods, in the Indo-Pacific, we Koreans will be there. We were there in Vietnam for 7.5 years. 500,000 soldiers rotated, and 25,000 of them were either killed or lost a limb or an arm or a leg. So that's the kind of commitment that we've had. We've been in Iraq and Afghanistan. As you know, I was there as well. So we are an ally that your staunchest ally in this area. So whatever happens here, whatever assistance that the United States needs, we're going to be there. Now, to be honest with you, my people don't want to get into a war with the Chinese. There's so many of them. But if the Americans need our help, we'll be there.
Well, let's wrap up on this then, because I think this is an appropriate place. Of course, we've just had the new Prime Minister of Japan, Prime Minister Ishiba, talking about the potential for what he calls an Asian NATO. How do you read that, and what do you think the prospects for some kind of multilateral alliance developing in East Asia based on the common threat? Is this a realistic idea, or is this something that's sort of fanciful?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. But as you said, there's a lot of challenges. And NATO itself is not perfect. So although many people refer to a Asian NATO, we don't want to become like NATO. We want something better than NATO. We want the Americans in the lead, and you know, something like what we saw in World War II, not what we're seeing in NATO, where everybody has to say something. You know, it's not going to work. So that would be something that would be worthwhile. And at a lesser stage, yeah, even a NATO style might is better than nothing. Is what I think. But is it realistic? In order to do that, Japan must become a great nation. And in order to be a great nation, Japan has to be more honest with itself. Why are you Americans a great country? Because you have submarines and aircraft carriers? No. It's because despite the fact that segments of your society have the strength to distort history and to put down the lesser fortunate, you choose to compromise and let yourselves sometimes being manipulated, and that's a great aspect of American society. And unfortunately, my Japanese neighbor just can't live up to some of the things that their ancestors have committed. And so, but the new prime minister, he seems to be a person who is more willing to do that. Now, you know, President Yoon, his popularity rate is at 20%. It's the lowest of any of our presidents in the world. And one of the main reasons for that is because of his pro-alliance attitudes towards Japan. So I'm telling my Japanese friends, look, guys, if Yoon is taking this much hit for the betterment of our relations, at least your prime minister, does he have to go to Yasukuni? I mean, even the dead souls in Yasukuni will understand the prime minister not coming. You know? And can't he say that he's sorry for what happened 100 years ago? I mean, it's not going to be that painful. So those are just small gestures that the Japanese leaders must do. They'll take a 10, 20% hit in their popularity rate, but they owe that to their future generations, and they owe that to the international community that's facing a big challenge from other actors in the region.
Well, fortunately here in America, we only have statesmen who put aside domestic politics and do what's good for everyone. I say in the middle of a U.S. election cycle, in which none of these issues came up at all. But General Chun, this has really been fascinating, really provocative stuff. And I just wonder, people want to hear more of your perspective on these things. Where's a good place to follow you? Are you on social media? Is there a website that people should go to?
I'm on LinkedIn.
Yes, indeed you are.
And Facebook, but it's mostly in Korean. You could use Google Translate, which does a pretty good job. But I'm really thinking about starting an English YouTube channel. I have a Korean YouTube channel that's got a decent, you know, 70,000 subscribers. It's all dull stuff, and yet these loyal subscribers listen to my crap. So that's promising. But if you will allow me,
we want those guys.
Exactly. Yes, please put out some English crap.
Yeah. So if you allow me, I hope this is an adult only program, but anyway, before we go, if I may, I have one thing that I must say to your audience. So I believe that every American is duty bound to watch Spider-Man 1 and 2 at least 3 times in their lifetime, because Spider-Man 1 teaches you with great power comes great responsibility. Spider-Man 2 teaches you that even if you don't want to be Spider-Man, remember, Spider-Man is being chased by the cops. He's trying to be killed by the villains, and Mary Jane wants to, you know, separate because she can't see him enough. So he wants to become an ordinary guy, and yet the evil forces don't allow that to happen. So you Americans, you know, you're like Spider-Man. And some of you don't want to be Spider-Man. They want to be normal. Well, go to China if you want to do that. But if you want to live in the United States and enjoy everything that it provides you, you must be more responsible. And so please watch Spider-Man 1 and 2 3 times in your lifetime. And thank you for your time.
Amen. Amen. I believe that General Chun means the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man, just for our listeners. You may have to go back a few years to catch that one. So,
yes. Thank you.
Thanks, General Chun. This has been great. Really appreciate you being with us today on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific?
Well, Ray, there's nothing like a Korean general to tell you exactly what he's thinking.
I love the straight talk. I really do. I mean, it's great to hear. You know, you and I deal with a lot of very diplomatic people, and sometimes it's good to hear it just straight like it is. So, well, it's also, we definitely got his unvarnished opinion on several pretty important issues.
Well, when you have a nuclear armed neighbor with one of the largest standing armies in the world just up there saying, "I don't like you," I guess it focuses your mind, especially if you're in the military responsible for dealing with that. But that being said, his call for Americans to take responsibility is a tough sell these days, right?
It really is. No, I mean, you know, we've said it over and over again. I mean, there have been basically, there's been almost no discussion of any of this in our current election cycle. And that's really disturbing. Just because this is the kind of thing that could take over our lives in a heartbeat if, you know, certain people decide to do certain things, and things that are very much, you know, within the wheelhouse of what they might decide to do, whether it be North Korea taking an interest in moving south, or whether it be Xi Jinping, you know, moving across the Taiwan Strait or whatever. You know, these are things that could totally turn American lives upside down. And you and I are Americans. I know a lot of our audience is not, but I mean, this could affect everybody. And as Americans, our political class perhaps, you know, has concluded that the American people just aren't interested.
Well, you know, there's something very attractive to say, you know what, everyone takes care of themselves. We're going to close the doors, close our eyes, and anyone bugs us, we're going to blast them to smithereens. They are problem solved. Yeah. If only the world were that easy.
Yeah. Well, I have spent a little time on the Korean Peninsula. I've never actually been stationed there full time, but I've been up on many, many military exercises, especially back in the 90s. Those were extremely serious affairs. And sometimes the situation, the real world situation at the DMZ or in other places would get very hot during those exercises. And all of a sudden you weren't quite sure whether you were just playing or whether you were actually looking at potentially, you know, things going real world. And those are scary times.
So I sense you have a story about that.
I do. Well, just, you know, we were talking just to a Korean special warfare officer, special operations officer. And we had a chance to deal with quite a lot of those guys, and those were serious people. They took their jobs extremely seriously, and there was probably no better example of that. So I was on the night shift. This is as a lieutenant working in the special operations squadron down in Taegu, which is down at the south end of the peninsula. And we would take up the Korean Special Forces troops in these special operations C-130 aircraft and throw them out of the airplane, right? You know, they would do static line insertions into various places around South Korea as part of these big exercises. And during one of them, the crew of the C-130, the American crew of the C-130 came back, and they were badly rattled and shaken up because one of the South Korean jumpers got hung up. And what happens is the static line essentially does not separate from the, you know, it does not pull out the chute like it's supposed to. It just gets hung. And so we call that a hung jumper. And the crew, you know, did what they could to make sure the worst things don't happen. So they tried to gain altitude. So if he, you know, if he did separate eventually, that he had time to pull his reserve. And then, of course, you also try to position the plane so that he's not banging against the side of the plane. And so they did all of those things. And in the end, the static line separated. And they went into search and rescue mode where they were kind of circling above and could not figure out where he went. Of course, these missions happen at night on night vision goggles. And so it's not as, you know, even though the night vision goggles work great, but back in the 90s, they sort of work great. But they could never quite locate where he went. And so they came back and they were like, you know, did we lose this guy? Is he dead? Did he fall? Did he fall to his death? Why didn't he signal us? And then through the entire next day, you know, they send in the helicopters to go try to locate this guy to see if they can they can find him. But the next evening, while the rest of his group there, his platoon was sort of camped out in their space. And of course, they're all upset because they can't find this guy. He walks into camp, and they're like, oh, and then, you know, they're like, well, why didn't you, we sent the rescue helicopter. Why didn't you signal it? And he said, well, I thought I was supposed to escape and evade. So he escaped and evaded the rescue helicopter for about 24 hours.
You know, sometimes you're too good at the job.
As I said, those guys take their jobs very seriously. So yeah, it was a heck of a thing. I mean, of course, we were all really happy, but yeah, it was pretty. It was a testament to the professionalism and really the toughness of and how seriously they do take the defense of their nation, because they are on the Korean Peninsula. The Korean War never ended, right? We are still all these years later at a truce, not a peace. So yeah, I mean they are serious about their jobs. Yep. Well, Jim, you and I are serious about our jobs, and we've now wrapped up yet another great episode. And speaking of people who are great at their jobs, we've got our producer, of course, Ian Ellis Jones, who's always does such a great job with this. Behind the scenes, hopefully when all of this comes out, you will not notice all the technical difficulties we had with this particular episode. But you can follow all of his other great work at Ian Ellis Jones on X. That's probably the best way to follow him. Of course, you can follow us on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/IP Podcast. You'll find all of our other interviews, including we may have mentioned that we had the U.S. Admiral and retired Admiral and U.S. Ambassador to South Korea, Harry Harris, on all the way back in episode 8. Now, he was there to talk about why should we care about America's Indo-Pacific allies, one of our most popular episodes. So look for that. You can also look for our other social media pages on LinkedIn and X. Where you just, you know, look up our name. Of course, if you prefer the audio podcast like I do, because I just finished driving across the country and listened to a lot of podcasts. We're on all those services, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, all of those. And finally, just from Jim and Ian, this is Ray. Thanks for joining us. And we'll talk again soon on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific?